At 85, Irvin Yalom wakes at 3 a.m., weeping from a dream. He's a young boy again, cruelly greeting a girl with measles, only to face her father's quiet confrontation about his thoughtlessness. This wasn't just a dream. It was a memory from 73 years earlier, a moment of callousness he'd never forgotten. Here lies the essence of Yalom's entire life, a brilliant psychiatrist whose career centered on empathy, human connection, and confronting the existential truths that shape us all. This opening to his memoir captures something profound. We carry our cruelties, our regrets, our moments of shame across decades. They resurface when we least expect them, reminding us that becoming ourselves is never finished. It's a lifelong reckoning with who we've been and who we're still becoming. Yalom's work has transformed modern psychotherapy precisely because he never forgot that young boy's thoughtlessness, never stopped examining his own humanity while helping others examine theirs. Every Saturday, 12-year-old Yalom rode his bicycle 40 minutes each way to Washington's Central Library, the only white child in a black neighborhood, the only Jewish boy in a Christian world, son of Russian immigrants who spoke Yiddish to each other but never to him. His parents remained emotionally distant, yet fiercely devoted to his education. When he wanted that American Flyer bicycle, he promised to use it for the library. Anything connected to education received their enthusiastic support. The library became his sanctuary. Without mentors, he developed his own education plan, working through biographies alphabetically: Henry Armstrong, the boxing champion, Juan Belmonte, the matador, Edward Jenner, who eliminated smallpox. Each book pulled him further from his parents' world into one of ideas and possibilities. This longing for mentorship haunted him. Years later, watching a play where an actress's brilliance is finally recognized, Yalom weeps, his childhood fantasy enacted on stage. Growing up Jewish offered only shame and isolation. His barber called him Jew boy. His gym teacher did the same. His parents wanted him educated and American, yet discouraged non-Jewish friendships, contradictory expectations that left him caught between worlds. As his bar mitzvah approached, this excellent student suddenly couldn't learn Hebrew. At the ceremony, his uncle chanted while the rabbi held up transliterated cue cards, unconscious rebellion against suffocating cultural constraints. His questioning extended beyond ritual. Even as a young teen, I questioned how God could care about drugstore knives with molecules of ham when the universe was so vast, he writes. He began eating non-kosher hamburgers on his way to Hebrew lessons. This early rejection of religious dogma laid groundwork for his later embrace of existential philosophy. At 15, Yalom's family moved to Blagden Terrace, a neighborhood with sycamore trees and handsome homes near Rock Creek Park. The rats, roaches, crime, and anti-Semitic threats vanished forever. When his friend Louis suggested attending a party at Marilyn Koenig's house, Yalom's shyness nearly made him retreat. Instead, they crawled through a window. Inside stood a petite, vivacious girl with long, light brown hair commanding everyone's attention. Overcoming my shyness, I approached her and blurted, "Hi, I'm Irv Yalom, and I just crawled in through your window," he recalls. The next day, he made his first ever phone call to a girl. After a few dates, he bet his cousin $30 he would marry her. Jay paid up on their wedding day. Marilyn became his true mentor, uniquely suited to civilize and elevate him. They bonded over books. She'd stayed up all night reading Gone with the Wind. Her father embodied the cultured life Yalom craved, loving opera and traveling like his hero Walt Whitman. This partnership would last over 60 years, with Marilyn becoming his wife, intellectual companion, and editor. The boy who once felt isolated found someone who truly saw him, an experience he would later help countless patients discover in therapy. Unlike today's students, Yalom had virtually no guidance. When he received the Emma K. Carr Scholarship covering full tuition at George Washington University, his path was set. From day one, anxiety consumed him. Jewish applicants faced a strict 5% quota for medical school admission. "My strategy was singular: outwork everyone else to make grades so exceptional that medical schools would be forced to accept me." This was common among sons of Jewish immigrants, for whom medicine represented the ideal profession, the joke being that Jewish males had two options: become a doctor or a failure. His undergraduate experience was purely functional, an obstacle to overcome quickly. He chose the accelerated 3-year pre-med track, living at home in a brutal routine of constant studying and all-night exam preparation. The toll was severe: fingernails bitten to the quick, chest pressure, debilitating insomnia requiring stolen Seconal from his parents' supply. Though I wish I had started therapy then, psychotherapy was virtually unknown in my circle in the 1950s. His only respite came during summers working as a camp counselor with Marilyn. This intense, self-imposed pressure would later inform his deep understanding of patient suffering and his compassionate approach to therapy. During his psychiatric practicum at Boston City Hospital, Yalom abandoned formal presentations and simply told the story of his 8 sessions with Muriel, a young lesbian seeking help. When she revealed her sexuality, he admitted his ignorance and asked her to educate him. This honesty created trust. She had never revealed her true self to a male before. After his presentation, he braced for criticism, but received only validating silence from the department chairman and an eminent analyst. At Stanford in 1962, department chairman David Hamburg granted him almost total freedom. For 15 years, he led group therapy sessions observed by psychiatric residents through a 2-way mirror. After each session, he dictated extensive summaries, including his reflections and regrets, then mailed copies to all group members. Though this practice required significant time and self-exposure, he found it consistently beneficial. His textbook, The Theory and Practice of Group Psychotherapy, eventually sold over 1 million copies. The boy who once felt invisible had found his voice through radical honesty. After reading extensively in philosophy, Yalom began working on a book bringing existential ideas into psychotherapy. Death preoccupied him. He had recurring nightmares about deceased relatives and believed he would die at 69 like his father. He shifted his clinical practice to work with terminal cancer patients. Finding that cancer patients were profoundly isolated, he created therapy groups despite oncologists' resistance. Paula West, a woman with metastatic breast cancer, helped form the first group, opening with a Hasidic tale. People in hell couldn't feed themselves with long-handled spoons, while those in heaven used the same spoons to feed each other. The group provided profound education about facing mortality with meaning. One woman transformed after deciding to model courage for her children. Unlike traditional therapy groups, these patients welcomed student observers, eager to share what confronting death had taught them about living. As his work deepened, so did his own death anxiety. He sought guidance from Rollo May, author of Existence. Their therapeutic relationship evolved into close friendship, and Yalom was present when May took his final breath. This work formed the foundation of his existential approach, captured in his phrase, "Though death's reality destroys us, the idea of death can save us by helping us live more fully with fewer regrets." At 85, Yalom continues seeing patients because he loves entering people's intimate lives. He's adapted to aging by doing time-limited therapy, just 3 patients daily, with careful notes to combat fading memory. Memory lapses trouble him, yet they bring one benefit: rereading favorite books with fresh pleasure. He finds comfort in rippling, the concentric circles of influence extending beyond our lives. He writes mornings and sees patients afternoons, splitting time between Palo Alto and San Francisco. With few regrets, he echoes Nietzsche. Was that life? Well then, once again. The boy who once felt isolated has become a beloved figure whose work has touched millions, yet he maintains humility, seeing himself as still learning. His journey from Washington, D.C. slums to international recognition embodies the existential principles he taught: creating meaning through work and love, confronting mortality with courage, and embracing freedom to shape one's own life. We all carry our childhood selves forward: that lonely boy, that anxious student, that young man who found love. Becoming ourselves isn't about leaving these selves behind, but integrating them, understanding them, forgiving them. Yalom's life reminds us that our wounds can become the very source of our capacity to heal others if we're brave enough to look at them honestly.